Ja, no tym jeden des ja kenam jana shalakya chakshun militam jena tasmai shri gurave namah vancha kalpatarubhyascha kripa sindubhyaiva cha patitanam bhavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo mahabodhanjaya krishna prema pradayate Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namne Gaurakrishe Namah He Krishna Karuna Sindho Dinabandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari वृषभानुसुतिदेवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभो नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैता गदाधर श्रीवासुदेवोर्भक्तवृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे श्री सच्चिदानंद गौर हरि की जय श्री हरि नाम संकीर्तन की जय श्री गौड़ीय वैष्णव गुरु परंपरा की जय साधु संघ की जय समवेत भक्तवृंद की जय गौर प्रेमानंद So, welcome. Good morning to all. It's my pleasure to be again here in New Zealand, and thank you, Balaram, for welcoming us here. Patrak, more specifically, for welcoming us here. And each of you for, welcoming each other in our heart. That's the ultimate welcoming, right? Opening our hearts to receive each other in relationship. That's hopefully what we are trying to do here today, tomorrow, every day of our lives in Sadhu Sangha. Give and receive, as Rupa Goswami will say, Dadati Pratigrinati, Uyamakiti Prishati, Bhunkti Bhujati Chaiva. Satvidam Pritilakshana, different loving attributes of the interaction between those who want me to become lovers of God are all based on love. Love is the final currency in the market, basically. I mean, in the world of love, there's no other currency but love. So Rupa Goswami says, giving and receiving gifts, giving and receiving prasad, revealing your mind, receiving the others. It's all in the context of the love currency. It's not just me buying a t-shirt for each one of you in a very formal way, very unloving way, and I throw you the t-shirt. Here's your gift, your yearly gift. Prashad, this is your prashad. I'm following Rupa Goswami. But love is the ultimate gift. Love is the ultimate prashad. Prashad means grace, favor. A gift we can give to one another, a favor we can give to one another. So yeah, it's all about welcoming, right? Welcome. To welcome someone is not just a formality. Welcome, please come. But it's an ongoing process. How we welcome Krishna in our hearts, how we welcome the name through kirtan, and how we feel ourselves welcomed by God on a daily basis, because the invitation is ongoing. The doors are always opened. The welcoming festival is uninterrupted. No, there's not a day that Krishna say, okay, today you are welcome, but not tomorrow. No. Today you are nicer, I welcome you. Tomorrow you are a little messy, you are not welcome today. That's not the case with the sweet absolute, with unconditional love. So we are always being welcomed. And therefore, we are invited to live a life and we are always welcoming, whatever comes to us, not only people, but life situations, circumstances, chapters of the journey, landscapes of the journey, however you may like to call it. We are invited to be in, to develop our, as I mentioned in my first book, to develop our hosting capacity, to welcome all that comes to us in life. Atithi Devo Bhavam, this famous popular line mentioned in India many times. Nowadays they are using a lot in for traveling agencies. I've seen that, interestingly. This is a very ancient aphorism. A very ancient aphorism that says basically, Atithi Devo Bhavam, an uninvited guest is to be treated as God himself. So it's all about welcoming, how we host, how we welcome whatever comes to us as Devo Bhavam, as it, if it is Deva, if it is the divine. The word divine, divinity, comes from the Sanskrit Deva. And Deva comes from the Sanskrit Div, which means to play. So we have to know that we are dealing with a playful divine. So whenever the divine knocks on our door, he's looking for play. The play is always exciting. So it has to be surprising. It has to be dynamic. It's not like a one boring linear thing, like we already know in advance what's what Krishna's up to. No. Deva means an invitation to play. And play has rules, but there are different plays, and the ways God plays, those are very unique rules. Sometimes they are ever expanding, ever moving. So we are invited to constantly readjust in the play of love, basically. The ultimate reality for us is Lila, and Lila means the play of love. Love plays in a very unique way. Anyhow, in that connection, today I want to share a few thoughts about some topics that I've been sharing in a recent book I've written, Evolution in Divine Love, that has been published, whatever, half a year ago. And it's a the main theme of the book is an exploration of how the nature of love, and therefore the nature of God, and therefore how the nature of the soul, and therefore the nature of matter, in other words, the nature of everything, it's in movement, it's in evolution, it's growing, it's expanding, it's in process. It's not a fixed thing that is static, like a relic, like a museum piece. But something that is ever fresh, ever new, changeless in its ever newness, bit a bit. So today I like to start sharing some thoughts regarding the first part of the book when I address the nature of love. Because for us, love is the goal of life. We always will say, if you're asked as a Gaudiya Vaishnava, what's the goal of your life? If you're a good boy and a good girl, you're supposed to say, divine love, prem, prem bhakti, whatever, different ways of replying to that question. Hopefully, not just formally, officially, but in a very dynamic way, in a very living way. I want that the goal of my life is divine love. But if we want to make divine love the goal of my life, first we have to understand. What's that? If my life project is to become a lover, then first, what's love? And what's the nature of love? Because only if I get it right, then I will become a lover proper. That's why in our tradition we speak about sambandha, avideya, and prayojan. So sambandha means first, get it right what everything is. And get a right picture of what everything is in reality. Get a right orientation to existence. Who am I? This classical existential question, who am I? What is God? What is life? What is death? What is love? What is this? What is that? And these are not just like one-liners, like three words. Okay, you are a spirit soul. Next question. There's so much to say about who you are. Who is God? Krishna's Supreme Personality of Godhead. I'm not against that definition, but unpacking that, lifetimes of unpacking. So we may have one lifetime in which get to receive all these one-liner definitions, and then we may need a few other lifetimes to unpack those definitions. No problem. And then you reach eternity, and even when you reach the spiritual eternal domain, you have eternity to continue to unpack the implications of love. It's not that everyone, nobody in the spiritual world thinking, I already know who Krishna is. I already know who Radha is. I already know who Mahaprabhu is. I already know what love is. I can tell you everything about that. They are constantly rediscovering that, learning about that. Perpetual students of love. Krishna himself defines himself as a student of love. If you will invite Krishna God to an interview and you ask, who are you? Again, big existential question. He will say, Radhikar Prema Guru, I'm his Shishyanata. Sri Radha is my guru, Prem Guru, and I'm his student in her dancing school. She has a dancing school called Prema Vidyalaya at the University of Divine Love that puts everyone and everything to dance. And Krishna says, I'm trying to learn some new steps every new class. I'm going and learn some new wonderful steps in which love makes me dance in a new way. And love makes me dance in yet another way. So that's the case for God. So to speak of us, how willing shall we be to learn the next new dance, the next new step in the next new dance? So every step in our life, even if it's a how do you say when you
stumble.
stumble, that's also part of the learning the next new step in the dance of love. It's not like have to walk perfectly, no stumbling, not falling, not there. All that can be part of the our learning to dance. It's all part of one same project. So it's important that when we feel that we are not dancing so nicely, that it's difficult to follow the rhythm and the tune, and I'm trying to make the step, and I do like this, and I end up on the floor, and it's embarrassing. But don't forget that the dancing teacher is unconditional love itself. So there's acceptance, there is forgiveness, there is love, there is a constant invitation to learn from the stumbling, learn from the falling. Sometimes I've heard in devotees circle the expression falling down. I don't like so much that expression. I am okay with falling, but if you learn from, I'm not saying you cannot fall down, but you can fall and learn from the falling. So in that sense, it's not a falling down. It's in Richard Rohr's words, it's falling upward. So it's not so much, oh, he or she fell or did not fell, but what's coming after as a result of the falling? If it's a lesson in dancing, a lesson in humility, a lesson in whatever, how can I call that falling? And maybe someone is externally not falling. It's very impeccable in his her performance, but internally is, I don't know, taking things too much for granted, becoming complacent, toxic certainty, proud, arrogant. So that's falling. So yeah, whatever keeps us in openness and awe and wonder, learning to dance, learning the next new step in the dancing, that's what love is about. I mean, literally, sometimes we hear descriptions of the Leela in which Sri Radha is with Krishna, and they are dancing, and Radha herself is dancing, and Krishna cannot follow. So it happens. Sometimes Radha will tell Krishna, "You decorate my feet," and Krishna will take a brush or paintbrush and, of course, out of ecstasy, he starts to tremble and he's not able to draw anything proper. So in one sense, he's not able to follow for his own reasons. Gradually, he learns the lesson. So So in this way, we are all in different ways and different levels, not to compare ourselves with Bhagavan Sri Krishna, but we are all in different ways and different levels enrolled in the dancing school of divine love, trying just to learn the next new step of the next new dance. And that's never ending. The dance never ends. Every night there is Rasa Leela in Golok Vrindavan. It's not that there's one day in Golok Vrindavan that it's like you receive like a WhatsApp message. No Rasa Leela tonight, guys. Yes. We whatever. We have outgrown our dancing. We don't know any new steps. No idea what to do tonight. Sorry. We'll send you further notice whenever we figure out some new fancy steps. You will be invited again. No, that's not happening. Every day, every night, new dance, new learning, new falling upward, even. Even the spiritual world, in the context of love. But there is this is happening in different ways. And so this is all part of what it means to learn what love is. That's my point. As we were saying before, sambandha vidhi and prayoja. So sambandha means first have a proper comprehensive idea of what everything is. So then comes avideya. They are you are trying to pursue that with a proper idea. And then prayojan. Then the fruit of that pursuit comes accordingly. But if I get it wrong from the beginning, my pursuit will be affected by the misconception. If I think, I don't know, like love actually is codependence, no? Toxic codependence, we all know what that is, then I will pursue codependence in the name of love. And the fruit will be the consequence of codependence, not the fulfillment of sacred love. Because why? Because I got the definition of love wrong in the very beginning. Maybe without bad intention, but just I got the wrong idea of what love is. So then I got the wrong pursuit of love and the wrong fruit of and bitter fruit of love. So one important aspect for me in order to define, and for me it was so important, I said, okay, let's write a whole book about it. What love is. And in the context of what love is, who God is. A coherent definition of God in connection to love, and a coherent definition of ourselves in connection to what love and God actually is. And finally, a coherent definition of even the world of matter in the context of love, God, and who we are. Because again, we can get it all wrong. I'll give you a few examples, just briefly. And many of these few examples, many times, are the ideas that we think are correct in our spiritual practice. Like love is something that you have to earn and deserve in order to receive from God. We may think like that. We may think Krishna doesn't love me yet. Had to perform perfectly in order to receive it. Wrong. But we may have carried that idea for decades in our practice. And that affects how we practice, how we approach God. And of course, having that wrong idea about love projects a wrong idea about God immediately. Because then God is someone who will only love you when you love him first. And until that moment, probably he's not very much interested in you. You have to impress God. Because if not, he's too busy with other stuff and you don't exist for him. An indifferent divine. Wrong. Just in case, wrong. So in this way, we have all these other distortions, and who I am, and so on. And so this world is therefore a chastisement place that I'm being thrown here because I'm not loving God, and He's angry with me, and I have to appease the divine. That's what bhakti is about. Wrong. Right. And I, as a soul, I'm insufficient and I'm broken in my essence and I'm inherently sinful. Wrong. Sometimes we need to start saying what things are not, right? Deconstructing false notions. Om Purnam Adha Purnam Idam Purnat Purnam Udachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. No? Basically, that verse says Purnam 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 Purnam. Everything is complete. What? Yes. There is wholeness and completeness in everything. In the source, in God, and whatever comes from the source is also carrying a completeness. So we have to learn to discover that. The soul is a unit of completeness, the world in itself as well. Divine love, God. Again, we need to, and I include myself in that, we need to remind myself or ourselves constantly of all the things. That's also sadhana. Sadhana, one form of smaranam, remembrance. It's not just remembering how Krishna did this lila or that lila, but remembrance is also a contemplation of eternal truths. Bring to my awareness those things that are always there, but I'm always forgetting. Krishna loves you unconditionally. The world of matter is sacred. The soul is amazing. Divine love is ever evolving. These are all eternal truths revealed in our scriptures and scriptures of other mystical traditions. So, smaranam is recollection, to bring back, to put it all together. Remembering. Remembering. Someone will say the opposite of remembering is not forgetting, the opposite of remembering is dismembering. So, remembering is putting everything what it should be. All the members, the arm goes here, the other arm goes here. It's a remembering. Not dismembering. Mutilating. God doesn't love you. You are broken in your essence. Material world is inherently evil. That's mutilation of reality instead of Purnam, 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 Purnam. There's wholeness, there's completeness. But we need to bring that to our awareness, remembering, re-putting that into its proper place inside of us. So that's a daily practice. If we are not disciplined in bringing those things to our mind on a daily basis, probably that won't happen spontaneously. What will happen spontaneously is that we will forget all those things. Because many times the narratives outside of us and inside of us as well, many times are in opposite to this eternal truths. So sadhana bhakti, in many ways, daily practice, being a practitioner is embracing the daily discipline to bring back, recall all of these truths. So again, one of those is love, what love actually is, the nature of love. Love is still evolving. Love is continuing to grow. So I like to say, we always call love love. You can call it prem, you can give it one, we may give it one name, but that one thing we call it but one name is always moving and evolving. So in one sense, it's never the same thing. It's always love, but love is never the same experience of love. No? Like I used to give the example, different example depending where I'm traveling. So I'm asking you now, please tell me some famous river here in New Zealand.
Waikato.
Waikato. Good Maori pronunciation? Okay, Waikato. Speaking Spanish makes it easier for me, probably. So you always call the river Waikato, Waikato, right? It's not that every day you create a new name for the river. Because it's always the river Waikato. But the river is always flowing. If it wouldn't flow, it wouldn't be a river. It will be just a piece of stagnant water. So the river Waikato is flowing. So every time you go and bathe in it, it's always new. It's never the same waters, but it's always the same river Waikato, right? It's the same name, but a different water, different waters. So it's always new and always the same in one sense, right? Always the same, but always new. The paradox. It's not always the same river, always the same water, always in the same place. That would be dangerous to bathe in that river. It would be toxic waters, stagnant water. Who wants to bathe there? No, thank you. You may change the name of the river if it's so polluted and so stagnant, right? You may not call it even a river. So now take that to love. We always call this reality love, 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 love. It's the same name. Waikato, 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 love. But as you never bathe twice in the same river, you never bathe twice in the same waters of love. Let's put it that way. Because love is always flowing, moving. The Srimad-Bhagavatam, we find, I mean, there are so many in my book. I try to compile as much scriptural evidence as I can so we can, our inner devil's advocate can be appeased and say, okay, this is part of my tradition. This is not just some new agey crazy stuff, so to say. It's there all over. Not only is there in one rare verse that you have to stretch it to make sense in the, it's there all over. So one of those places, famous one, is one of these beautiful verses of the Srimad-Bhagavatam when bhakti is defined. And bhakti is a way of speaking about love, which says, Sabai pum samparo dharmo yato bhakti da dokshaye. There you have it. Haitukiya pratihata yayatma saprasidati. So there, Bhagavatam is describing bhakti as the function, the natural function, and the ultimate expression of for the soul, for all humanity, sabai pumsam, for everyone, for the soul. Paro dharmo, the highest expression of dharma, of order, of harmony, of religion, of however you may like to translate dharma. Bhakti is para dharma, prema dharma. Prema is the final dharma. So. Oh, I thought someone was cooking potatoes or cutting. It sounded like Davis cutting potatoes. She has been trained the other day to sing, to move the legs. So yeah, next step, no? Ever evolving. So samaipun sampadodarmo yato. I wanted to concentrate on that line. So there it says bhakti or loving devotion is haitukhi. It has no cause but itself. Haituki, hetu means cause in Sanskrit. So haituki means something which has no other cause by itself. In other words, the cause of all causes is love. You could put it that way. Love is the cause of everything else. By just defining bhakti as a haitukhi indirectly, only that word is, if you play out the implications of bhakti as a haitukhi, means there's no cause to love. Love is the cause of all causes. Sometimes we hear God is the cause of all causes. So therefore, if love is the cause of all causes and God is the cause of all causes, God and love are one and the same. We cannot make a difference between them. So bhakti is its own cause. Bhakti is its own reward. Love comes from love. Love goes to more love. That's the implication. If love is the cause of everything, then love causes more love. Because more love cannot be caused by anything else, because love has no cause, which means love has no cause other than love. Love comes from love. Love goes to love. Bhagavatam says also, bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya. Bhakti comes from bhakti. So bhakti comes from bhakti, which means also that a new level of bhakti also comes from bhakti. The next level of bhakti comes from bhakti. So it's an unending current of love taking to another layer of love. Like again, another one stream of the river taking you toward the next stream or the next wave or the next whatever watery experience of the Waitako.
Like cattle.
Why?
Cattle.
Kato. Why Kato? Okay, sorry. I don't want to commit any local apparat to So one current is taking us to the other. So in the same way, love is taking us to a further expression of love, high to key. There's no end to the expressions of love. And that's further confirmed by the next word, which is apratihata. Apratihata is it's complex to translate, but it's something like, does this word exist in English? Like uncontainable? Like you cannot contain it. It's like it's like a river. Let's continue with the river analogy. The river is so powerful, even if you put like some what dam or something, trying to stop it, even that so-called obstacle creates makes strength of the river even more powerful, and it continues. So haitukia pratihata, uninterrupted sometimes has been translated also. So causeless and uninterrupted. So again, it's a very current-like analogy. It has no source by itself. Everything's origin from that. It goes to more of the same, more love to more love, and it's uninterrupted. It never stops growing, never stops evolving. Difficult to imagine, right? I know that by saying all this, I'm stretching your brain a little bit, and I'm seeing some smoke coming from some of us. Something that never stops growing, that has no beginning. But in one sense, also, that's in one sense who we are. We have no beginning. The soul is eternal. Just thinking about eternality is mind-boggling, right? How can you think eternality? It doesn't fit in one and the other. Thinking eternality. We need another way of, we need to experience that. That's what our traditions say. Yes, we have body, mind, intellect, all these different tools. And they are useful. We are to honor and take care of them. But when it comes to things that are haitukiya, then we need another way of we may use all those faculties to receive a revelation from above, to get a glimpse of something that has no beginning, that has no end, that is uninterrupted, ever evolving, ever flowing. And our heads will explode at some point. That's the idea. No? That's the bhakti we are after, Gyanasunya bhakti, which is a bhakti in which there is so much love that you are not even thinking about knowing anything. But you are loving so much, then through love, by love, you know everything in the most perfect possible way. But your usual conscious faculties, how we try to know things usually. Okay, I will read this book, I'll try to know and understand. That's not necessary because love is high to key everything. It's present so much in that mode that everything comes intuitively, spontaneously. You don't even need to read a book at that time. The Brajavasis in Vrindavan, they don't have a library in Golok Vrindavan. No books required. They intuitively learn the new dancing steps and the new lessons by the very nature of haitukiya pratihatava, the very nature of their love. It's not that they need someone to give them a lecture. All the great teachers go to Vrindavan to gather the foot dust from that place in order to gain proper love knowledge, right? Like once Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur will speak about the he was a great scholar, a great pandit, Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, even from childhood, even before his more official Acharya Lila, if you want to call it that way. He was first astronomer, a mathematician, and he was like a national genius in that realm by the age he had. And eventually, of course, he became the great Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta. But his guru was Gorky Kishore Das Babaji, who was illiterate on the outside, in superficial terms. He didn't know how to write, how to read. So that sounds very interesting, contrasting experience. On this side, this great pandit personality, knower of many languages, author of books, accepting as a guru someone who doesn't know how to read or write. But he had the real knowledge, Raja Vidya. No? king of knowledge was in his heart. So you didn't, at that point, you don't need to read or write. You can be perfectly literate, like everyone is in Vrindavan, in Golok Vrindavan. Bro, nobody basically knows how to read or write. We could call it a illiterate village setting in eternity. So be careful, don't get too attached to whatever knowledge you have, because you are projecting to enter an illiterate village for eternity. And that's why you need to understand the actual knowledge there is way higher than all the universities, Oxford and Cambridge and Harvard put together. It's Rajavidya, Rajaguhyam. But Rajaguhyam, the great, the king of all knowledge, of all education, is the king of all secrets, Krishna says in the Gita. In other words, it's very confidential, therefore it's misunderstood. Again, one looks on a superficial glance at Vrindavan, it's like they are totally literate, they know nothing. How can you call it the king of knowledge? That's why it's Rajaguhyam, very secret. You cannot understand it in the normal way we understand things. You can only appreciate that form of knowing by us entering in that same form of knowing. Oh, then you realize loving is the ultimate knowing. Loving is the ultimate knowing. Sriman Mahaprabhu himself, he also showed that with his Pandit Lila, as Nimai Pandit. Again, he was not a Vaishnav in his early days, though he was born in a Vaishnav family, but in practice he was more sporting in the waves of scholarship, so to say. Engaging in debate and wanting to defeat other people. He was kind of a genius, like indulging in his intellectual genius, so to say. I'm putting all Vaishnavas in now, they've been anxiety, basically. Because he will meet, see them and call them, come, come, come. What's the definition of mukti? Well, give me the definition. He will refute their definitions, and he will then refute his own definitions and bring another definition. And the Vaishnava was like, stop losing your time with that. Moral juggling, all that seems so funny, but it's so boring. So now I'm substantial. So all the Vaishnavas in Navadvip start to pray, Maini my Pandit become a Vaishnava. Maini my Pandit become a Vaishnava. And by the grace of the devotees, God becomes a devotee. That's Gaurlila, right? Gaurlila is God becoming a devotee by the grace of the devotees. The Sadhu Sangha is so crucial for God Himself, not what to speak of us. Right? Krishna Bhakti Janma Mool, how is Sadhu Sangha? The root cause of Bhakti is Sadhu Sangha, even for God as Mahaprabhu. So, my point with all of this is that God Himself, Krishna's Mahaprabhu, He performs His Pandit Leela. He shows how much you can know. And at one point, He enters into His devotee Leela, if we want to put it that way, a lover Leela. And he tastes love in such a way that he takes all the knowledge he had, opens the window, and throws it out. To show now the greatest Pandit on earth became a Vaishnava means it's not that now he has no knowledge, means now he has upgraded himself to the real knowledge, the king of knowledge. Raja Vidya, Raja Guru. The king of secrets, the most confidential knowledge. So this implies that love, which is the most confidential knowledge and the king of all secrets, is not so easy to understand. No? We have to take time to understand bhakti, take time to understand love. We shall be very cautious about too quickly settling for easy definitions or unhealthy certainty. I already know what bhakti is. Tell me something new. I already know what love is. Those who love will never say something like that. Those who really love will always, eternally say, I'm just exploring the sprinkling of the ocean of love. I just like Rupa Goswami, right? He's writing Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He's talking about the ocean of devotion. Of course, he after writing that book, he then writes Ujjval Nilamani, like implying, It's not that I have given you the whole ocean. There's so much more to say. And then he writes another book and another book, and another book. Like implying, I wrote one book and call it The Ocean of Love. But then I had to continue writing so many more books because that ocean is bottomless. And then you have Acharya's like Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur writing Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu Bindu. Let's explore one drop from that ocean. You can stay in that drop forever. No. A drop of that ocean is eternal. A point in that line is infinite. That's the nature of infinity. Over and over again, we have to remind ourselves this. Guys, we are dealing with infinity here. Wow. On a daily basis, you are confronted 24/7 with infinity. Even an atom from this world, if you take one atom and you try to study the atom, because Krishna is in every atom is infinite. What an atom contains, how much you can explore it, it's endless. So, on every possible direction, there is infinity. You cannot think all day about that in that way. You may collapse and not being able to do your daily chores at home, so to say. But it's say good to remind. A few times per day, again, smarana. Okay, I'm dealing with infinity. Everything is infinite. Go to that place of awe, infinite. If you are in front of the infinite, you cannot but be in awe. So the fact that many times we have developed some, how do you say the opposite? When you develop some, know, like lack of capacity to feel something. I am.
No.
Yeah, it's another word that I'm looking for. Brainstorming. Come on. It's more like a medical term. Like you become something. Immune. That was it. Thank you. So we develop some, we become all immune. Right? It feels like we walk over there and how many times there was awe in my day today? And probably sometimes the answer is no awe at all. So that speaks how much we may have forgotten. I'm dealing with infinity at every step. And it's okay not to torture ourselves to feel terribly bad, but just to bring the gentle reminder on a daily basis. Oh, I'm surrounded by infinity. It's a form of smarana. You may be in the bathroom doing what you may consider the most ordinary thing you could possibly be doing on a daily basis, going to a toilet. You can remind yourself you are surrounded by infinity in that moment. You can be peeling a potato, no big event. I'm dealing with infinity. This potato peel is infinite. Krishna's in every act. I mean, I will say that's a way better way to fill in your thoughts than many of the thoughts we usually entertain while peeling potatoes. And that's a form of contemplation that can be form become a form of prayer while peeling potatoes, while being in the toilet. You don't have to wait to officially enter the temple compound to be in contact with God or whatever. So one drop again of the ocean of love is infinite. One drop can capture us forever. So that's why every genuine lover of the divine will never say, I know everything. I have mastered the love department. Again, if there is someone who mastered the love department, that's God as a lover, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Krishna becoming a lover of love, Iman Mahaprabhu. So he has experienced and exhibited these love symptoms, these ecstasy symptoms. Like nobody else has shown across the history of religious history. Now, Devi heard me about talking peeling potatoes. She's peeling potatoes and cutting potatoes. So, no, it's nobody like Mahaprabhu in terms of loving experience. What he has to say about his mastery of love, na prema gandosti darapi meharu. In me, there is not even the aroma of divine love.
No.
That's paradoxical. Because he was a towering figure, a golden volcano of divine love erupting, the lava of ecstasy pouring that at every step, flooding everyone around him, creating a literal epidemics of divine love. And he's saying, there's not even the scent of that in me. And that's the paradoxical nature of love. The more love you have, the more thirst you have for more love. The more love you have, the more you realize how much more love can be had. And it's not even in terms of having love, well, because sometimes language can be tricky. I will have love. Well, like I'll become the owner of the product called love. But that's not how it works. I will possess love. No, you will be possessed by it. You will be owned by it. You will be had by it. Love is something to serve, not to have. We are sometimes quite possession oriented, right? We very much build our identity based on what I think I own. This is mine, therefore I am this. This is my wife, I am a husband. These are my kids, I am a father. This is my job, I am a whatever, architect. So one thing. And therefore the idea with love comes to deconstruct all that hamamata, that false sense of self based on what I think is me and mine. And love is a reality that you cannot possess, but just be possessed by it. So it's profoundly humbling. And of course it invites for an absolute death of the false self that is built upon these false notions of I am what I have, or I am whatever, what I do, or I am what I own, or I am what I, what other things of me, public opinion, possession. No. We are units of loving dedication. We potentially can serve love. That's our natural position, to serve love, not to have love. The goal of life is not to have love, it's to serve love. Which is not the same. It's just one word, but it makes all the difference. Goal of life is not to have prem, it's to serve prem eternally. Sorry.
No, it's just like that's why Prabhupada he translated bhakti as devotional service, right? It's an action, you know, like it's not a, he didn't just say love, right? Like you sometimes hear that, you know, and I think sort of a non Gaudiya circles, whatever, like bhakti is love, right? But Prabhupada said it's devotional service, you know, and it's an action, it's an action. Ever change, it's ever that indicates ever changing, ever, you know, like, yeah, not a thing that's just static, just this one thing. Well, you know.
And even to that, I will argue because sometimes, of course, as much as I appreciate the definition of devotional service, sometimes we may even misread that definition and end up, as we can take love as something, whatever, that is not actually love, we can end up saying devotional service, and for many, and it's an action, but for many, and it ends up being more an action. Only an action, and it ends up being doing things and doing stuff. And the loving part, the devotional, do you follow my point? So of course, that's not what Prabhupada meant, but that's how we in time may
It
like
just becomes service.
reduce the idea to just externally doing. And we forget the loving part. So, yeah, keeping everything in place. All the words have a very important place in connection to the other. So yeah, loving and devotional service also, of course, is action, but sometimes it may not be action. It may be just an inner disposition. Even if externally I'm not acting, let's say I fell sick for 2 months and I'm thrown in my bed, I cannot act. It doesn't mean I'm deprived of the possibility of devotional service, right? So I think that's also important to balance the sometimes the obsession with doing things because we are human beings, but very easily we go to the human doing department. And if I'm not producing, I start to feel useless. So it's important to understand that we have to be. And whatever we do is an extension of what's happening in our being. The doing is shouldn't be like a bypassing of my being, my being in love, my being. That's why Rupa Goswami, when he defines bhakti, uttam bhakti, anyavilashita sunyam, jnana karmadina vritam, anukulyena, Krishna anushilanam bhakti uttama. So he speaks of bhakti as action, as active, all that, but he's anukul, which basically means it has to be favorable. In other words, it implies an intention. It's not just the action. The action can be there, but what's intention in your heart? At the end of the day, the intention wakes more than the action, as we see from many instances in our tradition, where the action may not be there, but what's the intention? Again, for example, Kamsa's action was thinking about Krishna 24 hours a day. Wow. What was the intention? Trying to kill Krishna. So that's not counted as pure bhakti. Now, what's the action of Yashoda? She's tying her son to a mortar. Oops, that doesn't sound like bhakti. But if you examine her heart, her intention, that comes from a very loving place. So yeah, I'm saying all this just to say, yeah, it's action also. It's ever dynamic, ever evolving, but let's not stop paying attention to what's the intention. Because if the intention is there, even the smallest action is enough to reach perfection. No? Krishna says that in the Gita, right? Patram pushpam phalam
No,
toyam.
no,
No? Yeah. Well, but I want to pause there. First, he says what? Patram pushpam phalam toyam, just one leaf. One flower in singular, all those words. One fruit, one water, whatever that means, one drop of what? All singular, like indicating he's not saying like a flower bouquet, no? A whole fruit salad, right? An ocean of water, a basket of vegetables. He's saying one, just one. What is But then he says, Jome bhaktya prayachati tadaham bhakti. So he said bhakti bhakti twice. He said one of anything, but bhakti bhakti, like making it clear the proportions there. So your loving heart, your intention, that's the important thing. The external offering may be one drop of water. I'm captured by that. That's what Advaita Acharya remembered when he called Mahaprabhu to come. One verse from a scripture that says, if you offer Bhagavan even one drop of water or tulsi, one leaf, one. Bhakti, bhakti. Bhagavan is controlled by that, is captured by that. So, and of course, that's challenging. In one sense, that sounds simple. Oh, just one drop of water. Oh, just one leaf. Yes, but with full loving intention. So that invites to examine what's going on in my heart. Because sometimes we may end up doing a very ornamented, ornate,
Okay.
yeah, ornate offering, very elaborate. I have nothing against that, as long as that is not a bypassing of examining what's going on in my heart. You follow my point? Because in one sense, it's easier to make something beautifully on the outside instead of working on my inner landscape and making beautiful in the inside. So. Everything has to be. So anyhow, some thoughts I want to share with you today about love and love as an ever-evolving reality, which for me is a very exciting process because again, it's not a static thing. It's not something that is only one way. It's not the same river that we bathe in over and over again. And I must say that the whole book actually began. I have to say that here today. Specifically here, why? Because I referred to that in the introduction to my book. The one of the original Big Bang moments for me that took me to write this book happened here, literally here in this dome, like 2 years ago almost. It was a day I was here. I was staying here at this time, but Trac very kindly allowed me to stay in his dome, and he left. I exiled Patrak. He exiled himself voluntarily, let's be honest. I didn't kick you out. So I was staying here, and it was a rainy day afternoon. Some thunderbolts were coming, and I was reading. I think it was, I don't know if it was, I think it was this particular edition. Yeah. I own this particular copy a lot, because in part because of this is here, because I was reading this book. And there is one quote that I like to share with you, given by Srila Prabhupada, that I include this in the introduction. Actually, can read it from the original. Let me see which page. Anyhow, which page is that? Let's see if I'm. Let's see. Okay, two options. Whether I read another version of it, or I put wrongly the page in the end notes. I'll do my research. Meanwhile, I will read the quote as it as I put it in my book. So Prabhupada is saying, Krishna's name is always chanted by millions of devotees, but those devotees never become saturated. Instead of becoming disinterested in thinking of Krishna and chanting his holy name, the devotees get newer and newer impetus to continue the process. Therefore, Krishna and his name, fame, qualities, and everything in relationship with him is ever fresh. So the moment I read that, whether it was this edition or some other, probably was a PDF in my computer. It could be also. I don't remember that part, to be honest. And it was raining here. And I read that line, and a thunderbolt came. But literally at that moment. And I was going through an inner thunderbolt by reading that particular line. Well, the names of Krishna are ever fresh, and that's why. That's the only way, the only possible explanation why we can be still singing the same, quote unquote, same mantra over and over again for years and decades, and still not hate it. Let's put it that way, no? Because it will be torture, no? If I tell you repeat the same words 10,000 times per day for the next 20 years. For most, it will be like, oh, that's such a chastisement. Why you're doing that to me? But let's. These are the words. Oh, that's a particular. That's those are not words actually. That's God Himself manifested in sound form, and that's why Prabhupada say one. If one is properly openly related to the name, you never become saturated. It's ever fresh. I mean, and the name. If the name is ever fresh, name is no different from Krishna. Abhinatam Namanam. No, Krishna is ever fresh. And Prabhupada extends here the point, saying, therefore, Krishna's name. Fame, qualities, and then comes what was like the main thunderbolt moment for me. And he says, and everything in relationship with him is ever fresh. So when I read and everything in relationship with him, I was like, okay, what exists in relationship with Krishna? Okay, I started to make the list, and everything was in the list, right? Because nothing exists outside of a relationship with Krishna. Nothing exists on its own orbit. Everything is related to the center. One name for Krishna is Mukhya Sambandha. No? He in relationship to whom everything has its primary connection. Sambandha means connection or relationship also. And Mukhya means primary, main. So one name for Krishna is he in connection to whom everything has its primary relationship. So when Prabhupada says Krishna's name, fame, qualities are ever fresh, great. But then when he says, and everything in relationship with him is also ever fresh, then that means God is ever fresh, love is ever fresh, we are ever fresh, material energy, everything is ever fresh in its own unique way. So how is that the case? Well, the result of that exploration is this particular book. But it all started with that line, that thunderbolt afternoon, New Zealand, Patrick's Dome, 2 years ago. So I own a big debt of gratitude to this particular space. And I was not thinking about that till now. So it came now. But I mentioned that a few times, but it came now full circle. We are back home. This is the original womb of evolution and divine love. So for me, that's the point I was saying is for me, that's a fascinating prospect. Like everything is moving and evolving and flowing and ever fresh in its own unique way. So wow, how to establish a relationship with everything from that place? How do I relate to each one of you? That changes everything because generally, let's say how we relate to each other. Generally, we know someone, and at one point of the relationship, maybe in the first few days, months, okay, I'm discovering the person, something new is coming. When I knew you enough, I kind of put generally, hopefully I'm not doing that, but we put people in boxes and okay, this is who you are, this is who you are, and we stop discovering each other. But if everything is ever fresh and ever evolving, we have no excuse to do that. And we are invited to an ongoing rediscovery. So that's very, even in relationship terms, that's a very healthy pattern to approach any relationship, even with your husband, with your kids, with whomever, understanding what I have in front of me is an ever fresh unit of existence. Someone who is ever new at every moment. So I have to be very careful not to take this person for granted, not to put you in boxes. Even if I know a lot about you, there's so much more to know always about myself, even about others, about the divine, about the world of matter that sometimes we call limited, inert. You just bring a telescope and you'll discover an infinite array of things like a kaleidoscope mandala or something. It's like it will sound like a psychedelic trip or something. And it's you just seeing an atom in proximity. Wow. So anyhow, these days we will be trying to explore some of this, how everything is ever fresh, as Prabhupada will say, no? Love. Today we talked a little bit more about love. We'll be talking about also Krishna, the sweet absolute. We'll be talking about ourselves, the world of matter, how everything in its own way is ever fresh. No? Those are basically the four chapters of the book: love, God, soul, and matter. In eternal becoming. So I don't want to overextend. We have a few more minutes, so I will open in case you have something you would like to share or ask, mostly in relationship, maybe to the topic if possible, since in the evening we will have a session for questions on any topic. So to stay on topic a little bit, if you want to not only ask anything, but comment anything, whatever we share today, how does it? How it's landing on you, mother.
When the first devotees came to Prabhupada, and maybe still today, I don't know, but he said, well, we got the impression that he said, there's no love in this world, there's no love in the material world. And that was highly misunderstood in my experience. And yeah, that's all I want. Would you comment on that? I mean, okay, my appreciation now is there's no pure love in this world, but there's still love of some form.
There's so some comment. I'm repeating your question in case I'm recording. The question is not heard. So, Bhadra, you're asking that the beginning you've heard disciples of Prabhupada, him saying things like, there is no love in the material world. That has been highly misunderstood. So how can we understand it? We can see some form of love. Maybe we could say there is no pure love. What to say about it? I always, these type of questions, I always like to start them a little bit in a nerdy way. And by this I mean, let's go and define word by word, because we take for granted sometimes the meaning of words, and that's many times what puts it into trouble. Like, there's no love in this material, and we take for granted what is love, what is this world. No, there's no love in the material world. Okay, what's the material world? Because I just said a few moments ago, and it's not that I'm saying it, but that's in scripture, Brahma Samhita, in every atom, Krishna's there. Means love is there, because Krishna is love in every atom. So in the whole world. So what do though then what do we mean by it? Do you follow my point? So we need to put all the cards on the table, so to say. On one side, okay, we have that, let's deal with that. But also on the other side, we have that God is in every atom, and God's essence is love. So love is in every atom. So how then we what may have Prabhupada meant by there's no love in the material world, if every atom of the material world is inhabited, every atom, as I like to say poetically, every atom is an embassy of the presence of Krishna. The presence of Krishna is oozing with the presence of Krishna, every atom. We may have the eyes to see or not, but as we know, when someone becomes an Uttam Bhagavat, the devotee of the highest order, there are symptoms to the vision of each devotee, right? Kanishta Bhagavat sees God in the altar, the deity, but doesn't know how to relate to anyone else. Doesn't know how to see the divine anywhere else. But the curtain opens, Jai Bhagavan, Jai Krishna. Okay, great. We have to begin somewhere. God is in one place. We begin in that hyper-localized way. There is Krishna. The altar closes. Oh, Krishna is no longer here. And we start to behave differently also, maybe, because God is not watching now. When you graduate from Kanishta to Madhyam, you see God in the altar, and you see God in other living entities. So the vision of divine presence expands to encompass other living entities. Now, Uttam Bhagavat, the highest vision is there is not a place where God is not. Right? That's the vision of the Uttam Bhagavat. Jomam Pashyati Sarva Trasarvam Chamai Pashyati, Krishna says in the Gita, 6th chapter. There are those who see me in everything. In everything. Jomam Pashyati Sarva. Sarva means everything. And who see everything in me. He puts it in both ways, just in case. In case we didn't get one way, okay, let's get the other. They see me in everything, they see everything. It doesn't mean that literally they are seeing Krishna's like oozing from every atom. It may be a little like overwhelming vision, but they perceive the divine presence everywhere. So again, and that divine presence is made of love, so that's everywhere. It's omnipresent. No, that's another way of putting it. And I'm going back to Prabhupada's quote in a minute. But if you say God is omnipresent, which is one of the attributes of the divine, God is omnipresent, basic theology, ABC theology. We are not going here to Rasa, Leela, Braja, Bhakti. ABC theology, omnipresent. God is omnipresent. Okay. So it means God is everywhere. There's not a place God is not. That in itself is, wow, trying to stay with that idea internally. And again, between God and love, Krishna and Radha, you can make a full difference between the two. They're inseparable. So if God is omnipresent and God is love, love is omnipresent. So what does Prabhupada mean by there's no love in the material world? What I will say, according to what he has taught as well, is by material world, we mean a state of consciousness. Not the atoms of this world, but a state of consciousness which is egotistic, exploitative, selfish, which is unreal, basically. We will define it as illusory. It's impossible, but we insist on it. In that, there is no love. That's material world. For me, material world is a state of consciousness. That's the spiritual world is a state of consciousness. Prabhupada, many times, he will be in New York or whatever. There are many stories, but he will be in one big, how do you say, skyscraper. These big buildings, and he will say, okay, you think I am in whatever, New York City, or, but actually I'm in the spiritual world. So then what's the spiritual world? Because biologically, physically, he's at that moment, he was in the US. But he say, I'm not there. So you are where your consciousness is. Srila Siddhartha Maharaj will say, Vrindavan is a state of consciousness. I mean, you can take a plane and go to Vrindavan on earth, but if your inner consciousness is not there, you are somewhere else. Like this famous story that many times I quote in this connection, when Prabhupada was, quote unquote, leaving Vrindavan when he came to the West. He left physically Vrindavan. He lived in Vrindavan for many years. He left Vrindavan at 69. Right? That's the time that most people go to Vrindavan to
60,
stay.
65, we left.
60, yeah, sorry. Sorry. And in 69, he. No, 69.
Left in Durban.
Yeah,
Okay.
he was 69. Not the year, his age. Yeah, I got. Sorry. Year 65, he was 69. So I'm saying when someone's 69, probably they will go to Vrindavan to leave their bodies there. Right? They leave the other place to go to Vrindavan. He's living Vrindavan. So some people in Vrindavan who are living in Vrindavan will ask Prabhupada, why you are leaving Vrindavan? But again, our understanding will be he was not leaving Vrindavan. He was extending Vrindavan everywhere he went. And those who were living in Vrindavan physically and thought he was leaving Vrindavan, they were not living in Vrindavan. Because they couldn't understand how Vrindavan is actually a state of consciousness. Follow my point? I mean, not judging anyone, but just to make a point. If you don't understand that, if you cannot see who is an actual Brajavasi, someone who lives internally in Vrindavan consciousness, and you think that just being in Vrindavan is physically being there, and if you cross the line of Vrindavan, then you are outside of Vrindavan, then that's not Brajavas residence in the Dham. We understand that in terms of state of consciousness, that's a totally different thing. Right? So yeah, I will say that when Prabhupada said there is no love in the material world, he's pointing to as there is a state of consciousness called the spiritual world. There is a state of consciousness called the material world. Because if you are in this world and you become a pure devotee, a full lover of God, you are not in the material world. You are somewhere else. So what then we mean by material world? It's a state of perceiving things. So, yeah. We can be in that state of consciousness when there is no love. When we are not living in a loving way, when we are again exploiting, calculating, measuring, trying to control, for seeing ourselves as separate units, though that's not possible, but we can see ourselves and try to live our life in that impossible, exhausting way, separatistic way. Like there is this poem we quoted the other day, a poem by, I think it's by Hafiz, Sufi mystic. And he will say, he will welcome, and I'm closing my sharing with this because we started talking today about welcoming, right? So now it's coming this full circle. Hafiz is welcoming a soul figuratively, you know, like he's welcoming a soul, like he's saying, please come, sit, take rest. I will bring you something to drink. Will bring you something to rest. I will bring you something to eat. You must be so exhausted, so exhausted. Why? Because you have been trying to do the most exhausting thing possible, which is trying to live separate from God. You must be so tired to live a dualistic life, a separatistic life. So please take rest, my soul, my friend. I will bring whatever you need. You just relax because you must be so exhausted. Like trying to make that point, you know? It's so exhausting to live an impossible life. Like if I'm the center, if I'm this, so that's what we call material world, where there is no love. No love toward others and no love to ourselves, because to live such an exhausting life, that's a very big act of inflicting self-violence. That's the worst thing you can do unto yourself, to live a selfish life. It's so exhausting, so impossible, so daunting, so here we are trying to awaken to the reality of love being everywhere and trying to realign our faculties and live our life coherently, so to say, according to actual reality as it is, as Prabhupada will say. Not only Bhagavad Gita as it is, but Swami Padmanabha as it is, Bhatrak as it is, life as it is, things as they are supposed to be, not as they are not, or as we think they are. Yeah. You have something to share? I saw your hands raised. Yeah, just confirming you were raising your hand.
Confirming something that you said,
Okay.
that you're still te you're teaching, even though the material is world is in consciousness, and people can live here in full love with Krishna. It's the material is still around, and the spiritual is another realm. I just wanted to.
But also, again, we are using words, and it's tricky because I say the spiritual realm, yes, but it's a realm made of spirit, right? Spiritual world is not made of matter, it's made of love, which is difficult to imagine, even a planet made of love, right? A planet made of consciousness. Let's say Maharaj will speak about planets of faith. It's like a planet of faith. What's that? So, and again, even when we speak about the material realm, there are so many things, and we will be sharing more these days. I don't want to overextend myself now. Probably they will be serving prasad. But one thing as a trailer for our sharing on matter, which probably will happen in the other islands, so you may not be here. But matter, in our tradition, material energy is considered. Sometimes we will speak about material influence or material energy as Maya Shakti also. That's a way of referring to material energy. And Maya Shakti is described in scripture as a Vaishnavi, as a servant of God. So my point with this is just to further pound the post, material energy is not an obstacle. It's only an obstacle if we have the obstacle in our own consciousness. We find everything becomes an obstacle. But material energy in it, unto herself, Maya Devi personified, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur will say, is a Vaishnavi of the highest order. So a Vaishnavi are facilitators of love, not obstacles to love. So properly understood, this whole world is trying to facilitate the experience of divine love. Because the world of matter is an aspect of this department called material energy, presided by Maya Devi, who is, I guess, Vaishnava. For me, these are important considerations to bring some what I like to call paradigm shifts. Because sometimes, and I include myself, for some time in my practice, was more like a negatively oriented thing to, okay, we need to get out of this world, a more mukti oriented, get out of here. But our goal is not mukti, it's Prem. So spiritual life shouldn't be like an evacuation plan into the afterlife. No, we have to run away from here. This is bad. Maya is kind of this Satan of Christianity trying to make you fall with bad intention and enjoying your falling into illusion. She's a Vaishnavi. Now, the Bhagavatam said Maya Devi is somehow embarrassed of her service, like implying sometimes she has to facilitate our free will, and when we choose to be in illusion, she's there to facilitate that. But it's not like she's enjoying that. It's not that she's having a great time seeing ourselves suffering. She's a Vaishnavi, which means greatly compassionate heart. Her intention is that we may surrender to her own master, Krishna, right? So I'm saying all this just for us to, how to say, to develop a respectful approach to material energy. Because again, she's a Vaishnavi of the highest order. So if we insult matter, we are committing Vaishnavi apparat. And we know that that's not where we are supposed to go, Vaishnava apparat. So, anyhow, a few thoughts.
Wanted to ask, I guess in the context of hearing many classes over the years where matter is described in that evilish way, something to be kind of pushed to the side or don't get entangled or these types of words. If that's not the case, if some people don't have that kind of realization, then maybe that inhibits them from actually pursuing spiritual life in some way. Does that make any sense? Like in the beginning,
Yeah,
if
why
people think,
spoken
oh,
like
this is
that?
bad,
Yeah.
then they will come along and want to hear about something spiritual rather than thinking that, you know, what they're already attracted to is actually okay and be content if there's some discontent. So I was wondering whether that in the kind of with the idea of trying to encourage people towards spiritual, we use the Maya is bad technique.
Of course, I cannot tell you because of that. This is being said. There may be different reasons. An example that comes to my mind naturally is like, I don't know. There is a mother, and she has a child who is 2 years old, and the child is entering the kitchen, and there is a big knife on the table for cooking. But for the child doesn't make sense in his mind still. That's for cooking. He just sees some exploration project. Let's explore that thing. He doesn't even know how it's called. So he runs, and maybe he will grab the knife on the part that he can cut himself. So the mother sees that about to happen, and she will shout and say, "Don't touch that." And for the, like, if that's bad, well, and the child will take it like that, like, "Oh, that thing is so bad. I shouldn't touch it." It has nothing to do with the knife being bad. It's just that the kid doesn't know how to handle that properly. So eventually he will learn that's called a knife. You pick it on the, this is a handle. This is used not for killing people nor for harming yourself, though some people use for, but for peeling potatoes, like David was doing today. But at the beginning, it's like, don't go there. Don't, even she may need to say, "That's bad. Don't touch it. There's a monster inside that thing." So sometimes we may hear those types of languages, no? Languages, not because the thing is bad, but we are not mature enough to understand what's that, what's the thing. And we need to be still kept at some distance. But like, the point is that eventually that same person who is telling us that's bad should have the understanding that that's not actually bad, and gradually that person should take us to that same understanding. Actually, this is not bad, right? Because if that person keeps us at that idea forever, then that's not healthy, right? And that happens sometimes, unfortunately. But at the same time, it is perfectly understandable and justify why some people could say that with proper understanding, right? And it's not that they are, I don't know, lying to their kids. I mean, technically, you could say they are lying, but it's not. It's just they're saving them. The same example that we give sometimes. These are examples, not that the baby tells mom, "Mom, mom," again, a 2-year-old boy, "How did I came to this world?" And the mother cannot explain the whole procreation biological process. Like, a stork brought three from the chimney. And for the kids to like, wow, it's enough, it's charming, it's great. But you cannot keep your kid in that illusion forever, right? But it's enough for the time. And it's not, yeah, technically the mother's lying. But we know it's mostly protecting her child from being overwhelmed by that idea that is too big for his capacity and will disturb him more than give relief and contentment as much as he can handle. But eventually the mom is supposed to, okay, I told you about that stork chimney story. Actually, we are ready for the new version of it. And explain why she told that other one. All that should be properly explained so the child doesn't grow also thinking, my mom is a liar. My mom is cheating me. No, he can make perfect sense. So eventually he, when he is a dad, can do the same thing in a healthy way. So sometimes those things happen in parampara. Sometimes teachers may resort to some, even if you want to call them preaching strategies or adjustments of certain truths and presenting something on a partial way or different. But that comes with certain understanding and background, and we should be sensitive to that.
Right, it's used as a tool.
Exactly, a tool, and sometimes that's protecting the person.
And maybe another aspect can be to kind of challenge you and shock you into action. You might be so cozy and familiar with the material world, you don't have no incentive to kind of look at something else, really.
Or you may have, yes, or you may have a very distorted idea of the material world based on your selfish perception of that. And when someone tells you that's the material world is bad, it's like a way of shock treatment of like disrupting your relationship with that wrong idea of the world, which was harmful to yourself and to the world. Like saying that's the world is bad. So you stop, you pause your toxic engagement with the world. Like stop doing that. And eventually there has to be the re-education on how to approach that in a healthy way. Like if I'm beating someone in a very violent, unhealthy way, maybe a person will jump on you and the person won't come to try to first say, no, instead of beating, try to caress her and be loving and do a massage. It's not moment for that. And just have to jump on you and tell and take put some distance. And then how to approach that lovingly. So sometimes, of course, in this case, it's not that the world is actually bad and it's beating us. We are beating the world by being exploitative. So, okay, that's bad. Actually, it's not the world is bad. You are being the bad, treating the world badly and being bad to yourself. In the beginning, we may not understand all of that in one at once. So isolate the two and deconstruct some ideas and gradually reintroduce the healthy person into a healthy model and approach to the world. When you, at the end of the day, you don't need to reject anything, actually. The healthy approach to bhakti is there's nothing that needs to be rejected, only the wrong ideas need to be rejected about everything. When you have the proper conception of everything, nothing is to be rejected. Everything can be accepted from a healthy place. Again, like this story, and with this, we maybe conclude that some devotee approached Srila Prabhupada and told him, Prabhupada, for your sake, I'm willing to reject everything. No? Very much reject oriented. And Prabhupada said, the only thing you need to reject is the idea that you have to reject anything. That's what he said. That's it. You have to reject something, one thing, the idea that you have to reject, that you have to reject. Again, in the beginning, we may be told to reject so many things, but eventually, as we grow and mature and integrate, we realize, oh, nothing needed to be rejected, actually. Everything can be engaged from a healthy perspective. Everything is favorable to Krishna's service. There's one quote I share in my book called Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta describes all the objects of the senses as favorable paraphernalia that, when properly engaged, are none different from Krishna himself. Things like that. How can that, is there anything more favorable than that? But it's a gradual process, of course, no? And it may take time, it may take lifetimes to reach that fully healthy realization, because it's not only an idea that sounds nice, but also it's a state of consciousness where I actually seeing and relating to everything in a favorable way. Everything is favorable. Everything is conspiring in my favor, not against me. Oh, wow. There are no big enemies outside, like Srila Samaraj will say, the environment is friendly. Now, Krishna will say in the Gita 6:6, the mind can be your worst enemy or your best friend. As long as it's your worst enemy, you see so many enemies also outside. Because the word enemy inside creates that filter which projects enmity in the environment. When your mind becomes your best friend, you see friends everywhere. The environment is friendly. So the whole process is to, in one sense, befriend our mind, befriend our inner, befriend ourselves. And then we will realize, oh, there are friends everywhere. And even those who behave violently, wrongly, you no longer see they are my enemies. You just understand them with compassion. They are broken people. They may be traumatized. They may have gone through this. You feel compassion. You pray for them. You feel love for them in the form of compassion. So there are no more enemies. No. Like Jesus will say, love your enemies. You cannot love your enemies if you still feel them as enemies. So the only way to love your enemies is that they are no more enemies. And I love everyone is friend. I'm loving everyone. Everyone is lovable. That's Krishna's perspective. Everyone is lovable. Everything is lovable.
Like I guess struggle would be but like whips and
Many markets.
the people who were, or persons who were beating him, he was like understanding that they had to do it, right? He was like completely like not like these are my enemies. He was just like, yes, of course you have to do
Yeah,
it.
and at the end they were supposed to beat him in 20, what, 21
Yeah,
market, 20 something, which is just even one beating is enough, 25. And they were supposed to kill Haridas Thakur. And at the end of the beating, Haridas Thakur was not killed, and all the there are many things to that Leela, which is beautiful. I mean, it's very Jesus-like because he's being receiving all these lashings, and eventually after that part, Mahaprabhu is showing how he received the lashings himself. And Haridas Thakur was cured, and Mahaprabhu received them. But when Haridas Thakur was not being even harmed, these two people who were lashing him were concerned that, oh, we were, how to say, we were put in charge to kill you. You are not dying. We may be killed or even chastised by our master who sent us to kill you. Haridas Thakur said, oh, you will be chastised by me not dying? I don't want that to happen. So he died voluntarily. Again, then he resurrected sometime after. So, but then we have our resurrection Leela as well. But he, out of compassion for the potential suffering, they could go, I don't want to cause you any trouble. So by me not dying, you will go through difficulty. Then I die. Again, we cannot imitate that, no? But we can be inspired by the principle. Wow, someone can feel to that level? Wow, that's a real lover of everything. There are no enemies, literally, for that person, right? So again, we cannot imitate, but those are the examples that we keep on our altar, so to say, and we always can go and take shelter and inspiration from, right? So, wow, such an idea. Srila Haridas Thakur ki jai, Jesus ki jai, Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Srimad Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sadhusanga ki jai, Gaur Premanam, Pancha Kalpatarubhyascha Kripasindubhyaiva Cha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo.